If you watch television, use a global positioning system, or consult a weather map, you're receiving information gathered by satellites. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about how satellites work and what they can and can't yet tell us. And joining us are Christopher Small. He is a geophysicist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, and Scott Pello, Associate Professor of Aerospace Engineering at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Oh, great to be here.
Did I pronounce your name right? Is it Palo or Palo?
How
is
it? It's Palo.
Palo. Well, there were three options, and I chose the two wrong ones.
Let's
begin with you, Dr. Small. Are there any other satellites other than the moon and the man-made ones that are circling the Earth?
Absolutely. In fact, there are on the order of 12,000 other satellites, usually referred to as space debris or space junk. And these are just anything that happens to be in orbit around, in this case, the Earth.
Do they bump into the man-made satellites?
Occasionally. Fortunately, not as often as they might.
Professor Pello, what are the categories of man-made satellites?
Well, you know, satellites are often used, or man-made satellites are used for a number of purposes. The largest categories you can think of is commercial, defense, and science applications.
So we're talking about commercial, we're talking about communication satellites?
You could, yes, for communications, also DirecTV, XM radio, and things along those lines.
Do you know how many there are up there?
You know, I don't know off the top of my head how many there are up there, but obviously it's growing with time. In fact, there's a growing emergence of direct imaging satellites where commercial entities are now building satellites to take pictures and selling those.
I understand, actually, I do have a figure. 800 active ones, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists website, about two-thirds of them used for communication. I don't know how many of them are from our country and how many of them from other countries. Either of you have any idea? Is there cooperation in that regard? Would Russia send up a satellite and let the United States use it as well? I mean, before the problem in Georgia?
With research satellites are very often cooperative, launched by multiple countries in cooperation.
But I'd imagine that the ones used by spy organizations and the military are top secret.
Not all
definitely.
Of them.
One of you said not all of them. Not all of them.
Well, the military does also use commercial satellite imagery. For instance, the images that we're seeing of the Tora Bora caves in Afghanistan in 2001 mm-hmm. were collected by a commercial satellite.
So along those lines, you know, you can imagine a commercial entity flies a satellite, and then the DoD pays to get the imagery versus, let's say, the Department of Defense building and flying their own satellite for their own purposes.
Now, Russia put up the first man-made satellite, Sputnik. Are they still a major player?
They are in terms of launch opportunities. They do have an active satellite program.
My guests are Christopher Small and Scott Pello. We're talking about satellites on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How far or near to the Earth do the different kinds of satellites orbit? Does it vary according to their function?
Yes, absolutely.
Just follow up on that. It also, you know, what happens is if you get too close, too low in orbit, you run into a problem with satellite drag, and the satellite will re-enter. And if you get far enough away from the Earth, then the influence of the gravitational field, the sun and the other planets starts playing a role in the trajectory of the satellite.
So you have to really plan how far up you want each satellite to go when you launch the rocket.
That's right, and that's a function of what you're trying to accomplish, what the goal of the satellite is.
And how accurate have we come to be? Has launching changed all that much since Russia and the United States launched their first satellites in the late 50s and early 60s?
I think we've obviously gotten a lot better at getting satellites into orbit and where they need to be, but it's still a difficult job.
And how long do they last? Does it depend on their type and how they're used?
Well, you can imagine that there's a couple of reasons why a satellite on orbit stops working. One of them is, let's say it has an expendable, it has fuel, and so you run out of fuel, and that may last a few years. It's also a very harsh environment, particularly a very harsh radiation environment. So the electronics with time can be degraded due to that environment. So satellites, some satellites may only last a few years, while others, such as the Voyager satellites, were launched in the 70s and are still operating.
And as I understand it, in some cases they function a lot longer than anybody imagined. So is luck just a part of this whole thing?
Definitely.
Yeah, there is some probability of failure or success. And what happens is, a lot of times when the satellites are being designed, you're putting something into orbit. It's reasonably expensive, and so you want a high probability of success. So you take all the worst case scenarios when you're doing the design, and things oftentimes work a lot longer than expected.
Christopher Small, how do they actually work? What's the process for each category?
Well, it depends on what you want to image. There, most of the sensors on board the satellites that we're familiar with use reflected sunlight, either visible or infrared light. However, some are what are called active source sensors, using usually radar, where they'll actually transmit radar waves and measure the reflected waves that come back. And they see different things. Visible sensors see things comparable to what we're used to seeing, although from a different perspective. And infrared sensors see reflected light, very similar to what our eyes are sensitive to, but the infrared light responds differently to different materials. So materials that may seem to be the same color to our eyes in the visible can be very different colors in the infrared.
So those are the satellites with spectral resolution. There's also spatial resolution and temporal resolution, each with an application that is specific?
Correct, yes. If you sometimes you need to see spatial detail, and you don't need to see it very often. For instance, the spy satellites you were just talking about, they may not need to see an area constantly, but they may need to see quite a bit of spatial detail to resolve vehicles, buildings, things like that. On the other hand, if you're interested in looking at something like change in vegetation cover over a very large area, you may not necessarily need to see each individual tree, but you may need to see it frequently, almost on a daily basis, to see how it's changing.
What kind of satellite would be used to chart the progress of a storm like the one we're hearing about now, Ike?
Generally weather satellites, meteorological satellites.
Yeah, but I mean, would they be spatial or?
For something as big as a storm, and something that changes frequently, you don't need spatial resolution generally. You can get by with hundred meter pixels, but you want to see how it changes. You want frequent updates.
And how do they see through clouds?
Radar waves, generally. Optical. Basically, light scatters and reflects off of clouds and doesn't penetrate, but radar waves have longer wavelengths, so they're able to pass through clouds and reflect off the surface.
Scott Palo, how does something like global positioning work?
Oh, well, the way the global positioning works is that each one of the global positioning satellites sends out a signal, and your receiver receives that signal from some subset of those satellites that are in view. And if you can receive signals from at least four of those satellites, you can calculate a position by essentially looking at the intersection of overlapping spheres.
Is this one of those developments that started as a military project and then wound up having other kinds of applications?
That's correct. It was originally developed as a DoD project, and over time has exploded into not only the commercial applications and just the day-to-day use, but also increasingly into scientific applications, monitoring of plate tectonics, or additionally you can look at the signal as it comes through the Earth's atmosphere to calculate the structure of the ionosphere, and also the water vapor content in the atmosphere.
Should I assume that the Department of Defense has come up with new approaches to satellites that we're yet not aware of?
I mean, I think there's always development going on that we're not aware of.
Is there one satellite, and I throw this out to both of you, or satellite program that stands out in your area of research as particularly important or interesting? Well, let's begin with you, Christopher Small.
For the processes that I'm most interested in, the Landsat program is really a standout. The first Landsat, Landsat 1, was launched in 1973, and we're up to Landsat 7 now. And the Landsat 7... Actually, Landsat 5 is still operating more than 20 years beyond its design life, but the Landsat series is responsible for collecting a lot of the imagery that you may see in Google Earth, not the very high-resolution imagery, but the imagery with the pixels on the order of 30 meters on a side, so you can actually see human modification of the land surface with it.
And what applications do they have?
More than we have time to talk about right now. The applications that probably are most familiar to people are related to land cover change, looking at how both natural and human-induced processes result in changes in the land cover and the Earth's surface. But they're also used for agriculture, mining, reconnaissance rather.
And Scott Palo?
In my area of research, which is I'm interested in the dynamics of the Earth's atmosphere and the influence of the sun on the upper atmosphere, there's what's called the NASA Great Observatory, which is a collection of satellites monitoring both the sun, the intervening solar wind, and the Earth's magnetosphere, ionosphere, and thermosphere. And the satellite which I've been involved with there is called TIME, the Thermosphere, Ionosphere, Mesosphere Energetics and Dynamics Mission, which measures the structure of the ionosphere and the Earth's upper atmosphere to understand how the sun, which drives life on Earth, affects our upper atmosphere.
Can we spot them just by looking up into the night sky? Is it easy to distinguish a satellite from a star or a distant planet?
Yes, you can. In fact, I go out with my family periodically, and if you go out just after sunset, where you're in the shadow, it's dark in your location, but a few hundred kilometers up in the atmosphere, the sun is still shining. You can actually see reflections from satellites as they transit, and there are websites to tell you when the space station or shuttle comes over, and that's always an exciting event.
Well, a listener, Anne from New York, left a comment on our show page. She said, if most satellites are geosynchronous, why can't I see satellites moving across the night sky? I'd think that they would seem to stay in the same place, in which case I wouldn't notice them.
Right. And the ones that I was referring to are what are called LEO, or low Earth orbiting satellites. So they will transit across the sky fairly rapidly over the course of a couple of minutes, 5-10 minutes. But obviously the geostationary satellites are much farther away, orbits of about 22,000 miles, so they would be almost, I think they're impossible to spot with the human eye, and you may be able to see them with a telescope.
Are orbits perfectly circular?
The orbits range. It
because planets planets don't orbit in perfectly circular orbits. I wonder about the ones that we send up around our planet.
You can do both circular and elliptical orbits, and that's part of the mission planning. If you're looking at what you're trying to accomplish with the satellite, then you can put it into a different type of orbit.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking calls from our listeners. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-9692. WNYC. We're talking about satellites. We all use them. People are listening to us today on XM radio because of satellite technology. I'm sure everybody has used them. Well, if you have global positioning, or if you've ever looked at Google Earth, try to find out how your house looks in the context of the rest of the planet. I'm sure you have used satellite technology. My guests are Scott Palo, Associate Professor of Aerospace Engineering at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and Christopher Small, a geophysicist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. Again, the number 212-433-9692. And we're back with today's Please Explain, talking about satellites with Christopher Small of the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University and Scott Palo of the University of Colorado in Boulder. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we get to those calls, we've gotten a number of questions on our comment line. And Caitlin from Brooklyn asks, is anyone with the money to do so allowed to launch a satellite? Is there some sort of national or international regulation committee to keep them organized up there?
There's some coordination that goes on, but essentially, if you're a commercial entity like a company, you have the money to pay for a launch. You can launch into space.
So I could just, anybody can do it, and I might be able to hit somebody else's satellite. Wasn't there a fear in the past that that might actually happen for military reasons?
Well, like I said, there is obviously coordination efforts that have to go on.
It could be like croquet, couldn't it?
Yeah, well, that's part of the issue with space debris, the more satellites that get up there, the higher the probability is of having some sort of incursion, which is a growing concern.
And does that happen?
It's not publicized. I've heard of a couple instances of that happening, but a lot of times it's hard to discern if that was actually the reason why the satellite failed. It's hard to come up with a definitive answer.
Let's go to a caller from Long Island. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
Well, hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm okay. What's your question? And do you want to direct it to one of my guests or the other?
Actually, to both of them. I actually work in the television industry, so this is kind of a relevant topic. What happens when satellites die? I mean, I was reading a New York Times article a while back, and they were talking about we're putting more and more pieces of man-made equipment up there. And, the Hubble Space Telescope actually takes damage from microscopic particles that hit its solar panels at high speeds. And, is there any plan for if a company puts a satellite up and it fails, then they just leave it up there, or are they responsible for removing it?
Sure. This is Scott. What happens is NASA requires everybody recommends for everybody to have a deorbit plan. So as your satellite's reaching the end of its lifetime, you need to have a plan that says, okay, this is how we're going to get down. We have some additional fuel. We'll drop it in orbit, and it will come down after, some period of time.
And then what happens? Does it just burn up as it enters Earth's atmosphere?
That's right. Most of the satellite, due to the heat of reentry, will disintegrate on reentry. And there are some pieces that will make it back to the ground. It depends on what type of materials were used. But generally, it will just disappear in reentry. But there are cases where satellites stop functioning, and, they're just up there as what we call derelict satellites.
Interesting. What about the International Space Station? I guess that is going to reach its end of its useful life at some point. How do you bring something like that down?
That one I'm not entirely sure of, but I think, NASA's obviously thinking about these things and planning how they're going to handle that at some point.
Could you take care of them the other way and shoot them out into space?
That can also be done. Both of them require fuel. So, getting it out in the space generally requires more fuel than bringing it down.
Uh-huh, because you got to get out of Earth's gravitational pull.
Correct.
Thank you so much for your call, Ryan.
Thank you for taking my call, Leonard. Have a great day, guys. Thank you very much.
And we go now to Chris from Connecticut. Hi, Chris. I don't know what happened to that call. I did put it on. Hi, Chris.
Is it Chris or Charlie?
It's Charlie. I'm sorry. Charlie from Connecticut.
I have potentially a very sort of simple and stupid question. Do all satellites orbit the same direction? Do they, as well as spacecraft? And is that with the orbit of the Earth, against the orbit of the Earth?
No. This is Chris. Some satellites are in what's referred to as a retrograde orbit, which goes the opposite the direction of the Earth's rotation. It really depends on what the satellite's trying to measure and how often you want it to revisit a particular place.
So what would a retrograde orbit do that one going in the same direction as Earth wouldn't do?
It would see the same place more frequently because I'm not sure how to describe this without graphics, but it's because the motion is opposite the direction of the Earth's rotation.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So altimeters often, for instance, if you've seen the maps of the shape of the sea surface, the bumps on the sea surface, these are collected by altimeters that are generally in retrograde orbits.
Okay, Charlie?
Yep, that helps. And same thing with spacecraft. Same thing with Apollo 3 and all of that. They always were they all going in the same direction, or would they alter directions?
Chris?
I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because we're not talking about Apollo. We're talking about satellites that are orbiting Earth. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Chris from Connecticut. I mentioned your name earlier when I was trying to get Charlie on the air, but now it's your turn.
Thanks so much. I was just wondering, with existing technology today, what are the chances that we already have weapons in space on satellites?
You know, that's a good question. I think there's, the stance is that space is not to be militarized.
And does that mean that it isn't, or does that mean that we just are saying that we're not militarizing it? There has been a fear in the past. In fact, I think when Sputnik went up in the first place, there were many people in this country who were afraid that the Soviet Union could just zap us from outer space. Was that even possible?
Well, obviously not at that time.
It is possible now.
Well,
thank God there's no more Soviet Union.
You could potentially put, a weapon in space. I mean, it's fairly, putting anything into space, you can put it up there in orbit.
Uh-huh.
But it's a matter of what are the treaties and what are governments agreeing to do. And I think the militarization of space is obviously not the right direction to go.
Thank you for your call, Chris. A listener writes in, Jenna from Jersey City, says, I've read in Wired that private citizens have been profiled for tracking satellites in the sky. Basically, they can't be hidden, and people like Osama bin Laden can literally hide from spy satellites. Is that true?
Satellites are on a predictable orbit, so they're going to be coming around on a fairly regular basis. So if you know the detailed information about the orbit, then essentially when it's going to be in your neighborhood.
Another aspect to this also, in that it's fairly easy for a person to hide from a satellite because a satellite only sees a particular area in the ground very briefly. But trying to hide, say, the construction of a large facility may be quite a bit more difficult, regardless of whether you know when the satellite's coming overhead or not.
Well, one listener wonders whether, through the use of gamma rays, whether something like Google Maps could be extended to looking inside of buildings. Would they eventually be able to see through buildings?
Well, if a gamma ray passes through a roof, then presumably it would also pass through the body of the people underneath the roof, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm not an expert on gamma rays. I'm just speculating, but...
But you don't think that would be a good idea? But I guess what happens is, just as when the Sputnik was launched and people feared the worst, people will continue to fear the worst.
I think there's, it's human nature.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Peter from New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Great show.
What's your question, Peter, or what's your comment?
I just wanted to make the point that I was down in French Guiana earlier in the year, where Ariane Space launches more than, they said, half of the world's satellites from the equator. And it was just kind of fascinating to me that so much is being done commercially that, you know, may not be known to people, and then also the advantages of launching a satellite in the equatorial region, where the Soviets, and not Soviets, the Soyuz is are going to be start launching there next year, as well as in Kazakhstan.
Now, what is the advantage of launching from Kazakhstan or from Florida as opposed to the equator, Chris?
One aspect would be related to weather, and then there, you obviously you need stable weather conditions to get the rocket up successfully.
Mm-hmm.
Although this is a bit out of my area of expertise.
Do you know, Scott?
Yeah, I can follow up on that just briefly. It's also the type of orbit you want to get into. So depending on the orbit you want to get into, launching from a different location on Earth either gets you into the orbit or gets you into the orbit with less energy.
But we rarely hear about them being launched from the southern hemisphere. Why is that?
Well, you know, maybe
there's less to see.
Yeah, that's right. Or just where the resources are.
Nick from Putnam County, how you're on the air.
Hi. It's my understanding that satellites that provide satellite radio services such as XM and Sirius, and satellites that provide GPS services for motorists, that those satellites are in geosynchronous orbit. That is, that they orbit the Earth stationary relative to a point on the Earth. And to do that, it's also, I understand, they have to be somewhere between 20 and 22,000 miles above the surface of the Earth, depending on the weight of the satellite. And if that's true, does that mean my little XM receiver on the dashboard of my car is receiving a signal from a satellite 22,000 miles away? And do these satellites require launch from the equator so
Scott?
That they orbit over the Earth stationary?
Well, in terms of the geostationary orbits, you're correct in that those are somewhere on the order of 20,000 miles above the Earth's surface. Relating to GPS, those satellites are not in a geostationary orbit, but there's a constellation of GPS satellites which are in a range of orbits. So there's satellites constantly coming and going through view.
I've always wondered how those GPS things work, especially since they often give poor directions. You know, make this right turn when you know from having driven in that area that that's the long way.
Bad software.
Is that that's what it really is? So
it's not the satellite's fault.
But the satellites have been given the software, or does the tracking then come to Earth and then get modified down here?
Well, your GPS receiver just receives a signal from the satellites, and based on the signals it receives, calculates your position on the surface of the Earth with the software that's in your receiver. And then there's additional software, mapping software, that says, okay, this is where you are on the Earth, and this is where you want to go, and this is where I think you ought to get there.
So one satellite can be tracking even a million automobiles.
Well, you can think about it sort of like a radio station. The satellite's not tracking, per se. The satellite's just sending out signals, and the satellite knows exactly where it is. And if you know where four more satellites are, then you can calculate where you are.
Scott, aren't you working with college students who are building a satellite?
Yeah, we are. We're excited about that. We're part of the Air Force University NanoSat program, and currently working to build a nanosatellite called the Dandy.
And Christopher, what's going to happen? Is that going to be? I mean, who's going to pay to send that thing up into orbit?
Well, But the Air Force has sponsored the program and currently sponsoring 11 universities and provided some funding for doing design and construction of a satellite. And then in January, there'll be a competition, and the Air Force is going to select one university and put their satellite into orbit.
Is my satellite, I'm sorry, is my XM receiver receiving a satellite signal from 20,000 miles away, or is there some kind of relay transmitter on Earth that handles the signal?
I'm not familiar with the XM architecture, but I would doubt that there's any sort of ground relay system.
Yeah, I think both XM and Sirius are just sending them directly to the car radios. Chris,
yes.
you are measuring not only how the Earth is changing, but also the oceans. How much can you learn about the oceans from a satellite?
Well, it turns out that most of what we know, or most of what's been mapped on the seafloor to date, has been mapped using satellites. In fact, prior to the launch and collection, the launch of the satellite altimeters during the 1980s, most of the sea surface had never been mapped. And these altimeters use radar waves to map the shape of the sea surface, which is controlled by the gravitational field.
Thank you. I'm sorry. We've run out of time. Christopher Small and Scott Palo, we've been talking about satellites on today's Please Explain.